Welcome to RFN episode 351. I am your host this week, James Jones, filling in for our esteemed Dr. Jonathan Metz, who is currently escaping to Europe.
Yes, he's finally fled the country.
There we go. As you heard, with me today is the, as sometimes, Mr. John Lindemann.
Rarely a pleasure to be here with you, James.
Rarely? I don't want to know about the times where it is. Also with me today, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Hi.
And filling in today, I'm sure he'll do a fantastic job as always, because filling in sounds really terrible, is Michael T.Y.P. Cole.
Yeah, sorry guys, I don't have the charisma of Johnny, so you can stop listening now. There won't be any comments and talk back to this thread, because I have a curse of stifling talk back.
Oh.
Talk back killer?
Apparently. Seems to be a trend.
Oh, that's okay.
I'll comment in the thread.
Oh. That's right. Listen to me.
Some pity comments.
You know, I was thinking maybe I'd like do the whole thing as Luigi, but you know, you're a Luigi, but I decided we didn't need that.
you'll need that. Okay, I do it.
There it is.
The post 350 lol that we're going to be in now.
Yeah.
Okie dokie.
Sometimes I got to say, like, I like Luigi, but I think he might be a little bit challenged because he's the only one who keeps saying his own name when he's jumping. Like, you never hear Mario do that shit.
Well, Wario and Waluigi do.
His therapy.
It's his thing. It's what he does.
Yeah, he's a Pokemon.
Luigi.
Well, there was like a April's Fool's joke at one time on the Nintendo website where Luigi was like the 161st Pokemon.
So we're going to have a relatively normal episode after last week's 350 extravaganza. And since it's a normal episode, we're going to go ahead and kick it off with new business. And as tradition dictates, first up is TYP.
Yeah, so I've been playing quite a bit of Rayman Legends with my wife. So we've gotten the co-op experience here.
And oh, nice.
Gotta say, it's a lot of fun. The challenge app kind of turned me off the game, even though like I was really looking forward to it before that, because the structure of the challenge app is such that they're like short levels and it's kind of always egging you to try to do better. But since I'm not a high score attack kind of guy, I just felt like it was constantly saying, no, that wasn't good enough. No, that's not good enough. There's like no closure. So I was a little actually hesitant, but I forced myself to buy this because I knew I was looking forward to it for a long time.
Yeah, like when I played the challenge app, I was just like, this is not what I play Rayman for, and
exactly.
I never touched it again.
Yeah, it was the same for us. So we've been playing it. So Jenny's not, you know, good at, you know, the Twitch games, so she really likes the touch screen because it's something a little more approachable to her. And I think the game just does a really good job with it. I mean, some levels are a bit more straightforward, but others really rely on that two-person co-op, you know, or like there's a world where you're kind of like doing a lot of infiltration, or for lack of a better word, and you're trying to avoid these sensors, and they have a lot of areas where, you know, on the touchscreen you have to like, you know, tilt so that someone casts a shadow so the sensor doesn't see you, or you have to move the thing that has a sensor attached to it to avoid getting spotted as I walk around. There's just like a lot of really clever stuff. So I think it's just a lot of fun. I just can't imagine playing this game on any other platform because it's just, it seems so integral to the whole experience, really.
I mean, does it feel like the porting process would have been weird? I mean, because it seems like if they went and made other versions of this with it being so integral, it would have been a very odd experience to try to convert it.
It must. I mean, I guess you can automate like the second player kind of doing a lot of this stuff, and I imagine that probably does some. I haven't played it single player at all, so I don't know how they handle some of this stuff when you're playing by yourself, but maybe it's a bit more analogous to playing single player on the Wii U. I don't know.
From what Johnny described, you basically play with a tablet and a computer controlled Murphy just like jumps around. Not Murphy, but the other guy, whoever, the blue dude.
And the box. Okay.
Little box, yeah. And so, like, some people, a lot of people on the internet seem to be like find that a little bit annoying, you know, like, oh, I was playing platformer, but now I have to play this touchscreen game.
Yeah, I could see that as being annoying.
Yeah, I mean, so when I played the demo level, that was a concern I have, because I mean, I primarily play games single player. I mean, that's just, it's my personal preference, and it's what works for me in terms of scheduling and stuff, and that's my biggest reason that I haven't picked the game up yet. I mean, I enjoyed the demo. I thought the rock and roll level they had was really impressive. It's just that I'm worried that the single player experience will feel a bit lesser.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. Like I said, I've pretty much exclusively been playing the platforming side of things. Although, I mean, I did try a little bit helping her in a spot she was having difficulty doing, and it seemed, you know, interesting enough to me. And some levels are more engaging than others, obviously, but you know, there's certain levels where you're constantly drawing lines, kind of like maybe in a canvas curse or something to block things.
Oh, nice.
And there's some levels where there's a lot of, you know, there was a level I played the other day where it was really hard, where it's constantly, you know, running, jumping, you know, from wall to wall kind of a thing, almost like something you'd have in Sonic. There were several levels like that in the original Rayman Origins. But now there's the touchscreen. She has to, like, move platforms up and down and you know, or kill things in my way, you know. And so that's, like, really heavy-duty stuff, you know, at that point. So that's pretty engaging, too.
Yeah, it sounds way better than the tablet mode and something like Mario.
Yeah, yeah. So not every level is like that, and it really is hit or miss. One of my complaints is the same as Johnny's. The level select is really kind of, I'm just going to say lazy. There's like weird walking around just to like get back to the main menu. I think there is a shortcut on the touchscreen, but it's just very hard to see where you are in a level. I mean, all the halls look kind of the same. So it's just sort of hard to tell like what world you're in, or, you know, what entrance you're supposed to go to this other level. It's just confusing unnecessarily. And, my other complaint, I guess, is the pacing of the game. Because, like I said, the levels are kind of hit and miss in terms of the two-player stuff. And also, like, that infiltration stuff I was telling you about, it's basically every single level in that world has that kind of gameplay.
Oh.
And I'm sure the developers would counter that you don't have to play the levels in order. You can go to a different world and play some levels in that other world, and it's sort of a theme for each world. But I feel like, you know, a lot of players are probably just going to want to go through world by world just because that's sort of the methodical way of doing things.
Yeah, right. It's kind of like how you're trained to play every platformer, right? Like,
right, right. You know? So these things that I thought were really cool by the last level in that infiltration, I was like, I really don't want to play this. This is a really stressful mechanic. And it is. It's very hard. You have to coordinate a lot. It's really easy to mess up. And it's fun, but it gets grating after a while. And so I wish they had paced it a little better in that way. I understand that they had a workaround. You can go to a different level, but I don't know. I think that was a bad decision.
Yeah, I never liked co-op when you can kind of potentially have two people at odds with each other. In other words, other people can screw up what the other person is doing.
You mean, you like know? All the new Super Mario Brothers games?
Yeah. You know, that's yeah. It's just, to me, it kind of defeats the whole purpose of co-op, because co-op is kind of, you know, you're supposed to be
right, you're working
each other,
together.
So, yeah, well, I mean, to achieve a common goal.
Right,
you know? And you can
more
do that
together.
But,
There's definitely more working together in this game for the tablet versus the other person. But of course, you're still relying on that other person in a lot of cases. And so
Yeah. You
can still scoot someone else up, but it's not like you both lose if you screw
right.
up. Right. So
there's no like, yeah. Well, at least I made it out kind of sentiment to it. It's you both
right.
have to succeed
yeah.
or both fail.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I personally find it hard to play sometimes with people who I'd like to play video games with, but I know that they are going to be, I don't like to use the word anchor, that's unkind, but they are going to make my experience less enjoyable.
Right.
Well, that's the thing. It's like when you know the game so much more than they do, and you're just better than they are at the game, you can't help it, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's kind of inevitable.
Yeah.
And every time I try to introduce people to Smash Brothers, like, that's not co-op, but the playing field is so uneven. And then when I play with people who actually know how to play Smash Brothers, it's also uneven because I suck. But
yeah,
if you play against people who haven't learned the characters and they don't know what they were doing, and it's not pleasant.
Sure.
you know?
Yeah, and it takes you a while to learn the characters properly, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And it's so kind it's like of, somebody just picking it up. It's tough.
Yeah, and like in Mario, like people just end up bubbling up all the time while one person goes through to the end of the level. And again, I'm not so sure how enjoyable that is for anyone.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, I like what they did with the Murphy role in the game, because I think it really alleviates that problem. You're only tangentially dependent on the person who is at the controls of Murphy. And most of the stuff there, well, I mean, I guess it depends on the level. I would guess a lot of the stuff there isn't.
I'd say that's true for about 75% of the levels. There's some levels you really are intrinsically coordinating. Mm.
So those might be the ones where, I mean, to me, what I've experienced is usually it's more frustrating for the other player than it is for me. And I feel like the Murphy experience, except for maybe that quarter of the levels, handles that okay.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite levels so far, and I think there are actually a couple of them, but there's a level where the Murphy character is controlling this coin that you jump on. And so the coin is used to like block fire that's like shooting out from below or above or lava. And so you have to kind of under that and then go above that. And then there are other sections where you hop on it and it becomes kind of like almost like a shooter where they're controlling where you move and you're facing forward or backward or trying to shoot enemies. And then there are sections where like you hop off and you can hover because there's air currents. So it's the Murphy character really is kind of a primary role in that because they're controlling where you go. So I just thought it was really cool how they mixed it up, you know. So I don't know. I'm pretty impressed with what they've done in this game. I'm not going to say it's my favorite game ever. I'm not going to say that, you know, it's a game I can play for hours on end. I do kind of fatigue of it in part because there is this tension of coordinating with someone else. And when you mess up, the other person gets upset or, you know, there's a bit of that. But it's definitely a unique experience and a very good use of the gamepad.
Nice.
So I guess we'll move on then. Nice transition. Slide right in there. So we have another Wii U game this week. That's two of them. This time with
that's pretty
this
crazy.
Time Gee. I know. This time Gee has the new release Wonderful 101. Hit it.
I do. Yeah, I downloaded that thing, you know, like at midnight on the Sunday. I really, really was eager to play this game. And, like, it's basically everything I've ever dreamed of. So I'm pretty happy with the purchase. And there's a lot of people who are kind of on the fence, I think, because this week we got two emails of, like, two people saying, I was looking at this and I wasn't sure, like, $60? And, I almost downloaded it, but I need to know more about it. Well, a good way to know more about it is to play the demo for sure, because that's a very good representation of what the end game is. I mean, the final game is.
I downloaded that demo. I have not played it at all.
Hmm. Well, I would suggest play the demo and then perhaps seek out a video of, you know, explaining the different mechanics
right.
If you're really not having a good time with it, and then play the demo again. I did not, like, I tried to learn the game on my own, and I was fine with that, but I think there's a lot of techniques in there that probably escape me still, and that I could be doing much better in the levels if I knew them.
Yeah, I definitely got that impression playing the E3 demo that, like, I didn't get how to dodge or block correctly.
Right. And initially, the game starts you off very slowly. Initially, you don't even have the superhero costume on. All you do is you run into these people in need of help to add them to your group of rescued people. But you can't do anything with them. And then there's a cutscene. And then you get the ability to jump. And then there's a cutscene. And then finally, you can punch. Another cutscene, like the intro is a little bit excruciating that way. Like, it's all very colorful and nice. Like, it's all a big homage, I guess, to shows like Power Rangers. But those shows don't do anything for me, you know, like I didn't grow up with the Power Rangers. So I'm like, I'm, you know, like the humor is about on the level of Beautiful Joe.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, no,
on
it does
make sense.
On a bunch
of levels, actually.
Yeah, like it's the same creator and it's the same inspirations,
yeah.
Right? But I was hoping that perhaps like the writing would have gotten a little bit better, and I don't think it has. Like, there's a couple of cute things during the intro. Like, it's all very tongue-in-cheek. It's all very cute, but it didn't really make me laugh out loud. But anyway, like, the game itself, like, the combat mechanics and everything are really fantastic, but they really ease you into them, and without really explaining anything. You know, like, but this, you start off with just one ability, the ability to draw a fist, and then that's what you use as your first attack. And then quickly after that, you get the sword, and you learn how to use that. And so, like, each of these main abilities are introduced one after the other, mm-hmm. but over the course of, you know, one per mission in the main game. So I'm still, like, I still haven't learned how to draw a bomb or anything. Like, there's many abilities that I'm still missing at this point.
So are these abilities things that you gain by rescuing the, like, members of the Wonderful 101?
Yeah, see, that's where things get a little bit confusing. So, like, these abilities that I mentioned, like, the different weapons, you gain, basically, you have no choice but to gain them through the story. But you also gain additional people to add to gain more power.
Right.
Right.
By basically rescuing them in missions. And those you have to find. Additionally, you have these platinum coins. And all the game has told me is that if I get them, something good will happen. But it hasn't explained to me, like, anything about that. And then there's, like, this kind of wonderful mart that pops up out of nowhere, like, out of the ground each time you finish a mission. So that's where you can by a variety of other power-ups. And again, like, things are very poorly explained there, and you kind of have to feel your way through the whole thing. I don't know. Like, there's some things that I wish were better explained, but and most of those things have to do with the UI and the way that, you know, certain things about, like, how the game is structured. So those things I wish were better explained. There are other things that are not explained, but that are satisfying to find. There's another, you know, element of discovery in this game, and it's like learning how to find, like, the weaknesses of different enemies, learning how to fight, different types of enemies.
No, you're right.
Well, you have to find their vulnerability by choosing the right technique or combination of techniques.
Yeah, and so, like, in that case, I find the fact that nothing is really explained way more satisfying. You know, like, I wish they told me, like, what to buy in the Wonderful Mart, but I'm glad that I'm not hit by tutorial after tutorial after tutorial every time a new enemy pops up, you know? So, like, it's just, like, very satisfying to figure out, oh, okay, so if I punch this enemy, he's gonna topple, and then I can use the sword, and I'm gonna split him in half, and, you know, like, there's all these strategies that you can discover for yourself, and it's really, really cool.
That's kind of weird. So... If they slowly introduce things, and yet they don't explain those things they're slowly introducing. That's kind of a weird...
The whole point is that you're supposed to experiment, right? Like, usually when you get a new ability, like a new weapon especially, then they're going to immediately put you up against the type of enemy that this is good against. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're completely in the dark. Like, you get the whip, and then immediately after you see a spiky enemy, and you learn that you can use the whip to detach the spiky plates that the enemy has on its body to expose its weakness, you know? And then soon after that, you see that there's some sort of, like, hook that you can swing from. So basically, like, all the uses of the whip are explained to you that way. Like, I mean, it's not explained, but you're immediately put in the situations where you're going to have to use them.
Yeah. It sort of guides you.
So the primary game mechanics sound like, you know, they're kind of self-explanatory and fun experience, but some of these periphery stuff are kind of...
Right.
I'm going to avoid using the word obtuse because someone doesn't like that word, but...
they're not immediately presented.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or some of the satisfaction also is, like, trying these new weapons on enemies that you've seen before and seeing if you're actually more effective now against mm-hmm. them than you were before. So that's really, really
and
cool.
And that's sort of, you know, part of how that team operates. A lot of their games do a lot of that same stuff. They gradually give you more toys, but they really put the onus on you to go back and try to adapt to using them and see if they fit your playstyle.
Yeah, and the truth is, like, there's a lot of secrets in the levels. The levels are huge. They're actually a little bit too long. You know, it can take, like, 40 minutes to finish a chapter, and or more than 40 minutes. And it's, like, that seems a little bit long to me. You know, like, kind of like the longer levels in Beautiful Joe, I guess. And those places are packed with secrets, and you can't find all the secrets initially without certain power-ups. So you're going to have to go back and explore more once you get more abilities, you know. And that, you know, in turn gives you more opportunities to test out your new skills and see how they work. And I'm not at the end of the game yet, but I've heard that there's some sort of, you know, I'm probably not spoiling anything. If you've played a Platinum game, there's like a boss gauntlet at the end.
Right.
That's just something they do. Like, all the past bosses that you've fought, you're going to have to fight them again. So I'm expecting that, you know, like, I'm going to do very short work of them in that final gauntlet, just because I'll have so many more tools at my disposal, and I'll have learned the weaknesses, and I'll, you know, I'll be able to hit them directly with all I got, you know.
It would be very interesting if there are, you know, vulnerabilities or, you know, weak points for with newer weapons that you weren't able to exploit the first time around.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. And that's kind of the way that Beautiful Joe was. Like, sometimes, like, you fought a boss and turns out that you could have beaten him much faster if you had, like, this other power-up. Right. Yeah. So I'm expecting that to happen here as well.
I mean, that's not just a Platinum Clover thing. That's a Capcom thing. Mm-hmm. That goes back to the first Mega Man games.
Yeah, and like, some people specifically asked me, like, how the multiplayer is. It's a little bit chaotic, I gotta admit. And you're gonna have to have someone.
Is it local or is it online? What do we get?
No, it's only local. And it's up to 5 people playing. So, like, someone on the gamepad and 4 other people using the Wii U Pro controller, or the Wii Pro controller as well also works. Like, the legacy controllers also work. And so, like, you're each a different color. You have access to all the different weapons that you've unlocked. And actually, you have access to all the weapons in the game, but you also have access to whatever upgrades you purchased in the story mission. But these kind of, they're called the wonderful missions. Like, they're separated from the main game, and they're kind of arena type things set in settings that are in the main story. So right. It's not, you know, mind blowing. They're much shorter. Like, if you've only got a couple of minutes to kill, like, that's probably what you want to be doing. You can play them solo as well. But yeah, like, it's not that extensive. I'm not sure what I don't know what the motivation could be to go back to them over and over again. Because as far as I can tell, I think maybe there's only 6 of those. So yeah.
Now, are they objective based, or, like, what are you actually doing?
No, in those, like, you're basically just defeating all enemies.
Okay.
Yeah.
It seems pretty tacked on.
Yeah. It seems like it could get really repetitive.
Yeah, but I played it with the girlfriend just before recording this, and it was pretty fun. And actually, like, she had just picked the controller for the first time, you know, a few minutes before I made her go through, like, the prologue mission and the main story. And then, like, okay, like, you're on your own. Good luck. And we still managed, like, she still managed to get more points than I did in some parts of the missions. And it was pretty fun. It was less confusing than I feared it would be. But then again, it was only 2 of us.
Sure.
I can't imagine 5 people. The thing was slow to a crawl.
Yeah, I mean, just playing it single player, it can be completely nuts. I can't imagine what it's like with 5 people on screen.
You kind of get used to the madness, though. Like, eventually, you start to really focus on just looking at your main character, and
it slows down.
Yeah, it becomes less intimidating the more you get familiar with the game.
Right. So, all right, let's move on, I guess, to John, who has another game that's all about. There's no good transition here.
I have another Nintendo game. How's about that, James?
But it's not. Wow. I mean,
kind of. You know, I'm not talking about a PS3 game.
There we go. All right, fine. Yeah.
Another game on Nintendo systems. So last week I talked about Ninja Gaiden 2: The Dark Sword of Chaos, which I feel like I should announce like Lord of Thunder, but I refuse to do
the
that.
Dark Sword of Chaos.
I refuse to do that because I'm above
Ninja
that.
Ninja Gaiden 2:
that.
The Dark Sword of Chaos.
So I got the original Ninja Gaiden, Just because I kind of wanted to, you know, on Twitter, we were kind of going back and forth, about, you know, which one was harder and kind of thing. And definitely Dark Sword of Chaos is harder, of the two. Because right now, I think I've gone through about, I think I'm on, out of six stages, I think I'm on stage 5-2.
Okay, yeah, but that's deceiving, though, because it's really the last two chapters or stages or whatever in the first game that are just maddeningly hard. Because you before mean, that, it's kind of a cakewalk.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of been, it hasn't been too hard. The thing is, what I think the big weakness of this game is, I think the platforming, I mean, it has, you know, the enemies repeat and stuff like that, and if you scroll to the left and then scroll back to the right, they come back and that kind of stuff. But I think what's really weak is, like, the bosses are pretty weak. I mean, pretty much you can stand in one place and just hack away at them until they die.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the one boss in particular that I was pretty amazed at how poorly designed it was, because it's these two kind of dog-like demon creatures.
I know exactly what boss you're talking about.
On two pillars. And literally, you can just stand there under one pillar and they will never hit you.
Well, yeah, and sometimes the enemies, or the bosses especially, kind of get stuck in a cycle.
Yeah.
You could just stand there and watch them do the same five attacks and never hit you.
Yeah, I mean, this boss, I couldn't believe it. Like, I could have just walked away from the game. And they also shoot fire. They shoot fireballs, but those fireballs are always shot above your head. So you can stand there on the pillar and just sit there and watch them, and they will never hit you.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah, and then, I mean, and when they come close to you, you just hack away at them a couple times. And, I mean, they only have, like, 20 health or whatever, little however many bars of health there are. I mean, it's not – I mean, just the bosses are pretty weak. So I don't really know how they are. I'm going to actually take a look at that when I play through Dark Sword Chaos. But yeah, I mean, it's starting to get hard here at the end. It's a little bit – the thing is, what I think – it's kind of cheap, though, because they set up some of the cliffs are set up so that you have to, instead of, because you're so used to traversing everything, going upwards, right? Mm-hmm. So you're always climbing and climbing and climbing. But what they do is, you know, is they start to actually have areas where you have to hop down. And make sure that you push over to the right far enough so that you catch onto the wall and then hop down again to the net, to further down the wall on the other side. And it just, it gets, you know, it's so easy to, you know, if you press to the right too far, you'll miss the last area on the cliff where you can catch. And it's pretty cheap. It's just a pretty cheap way to make the game harder.
Yeah, if anyone has never played the first Ninja Gaiden, like, there's something about the controls. I don't know what it is, but it's really, really hard to just, like, when you jump and you press left or right, like, against the wall, you're going to cling to it. And then you're kind of asked to, okay, press away from the wall and then towards the wall again. And it's like, you have to do it so quickly.
Yeah, you're reverse wall jumping, basically.
Yeah, yep. And it's super, super hard. And yeah, like, having to go down walls.
Unless you're good at video games.
The people who made this game are dicks.
Well, like, that's
I think
the thing.
That's a fact.
The thing is, it's so weird because, you know, you play all the way through to the game until nearly the end. And then you kind of come up to this one area where the first time you have to do that, and you're like, what the hell do I even do here? I don't even know. Because you're just looking at it, it looks like suicide. You're like, mm-hmm. There's no way that I can do that with the tools that I have at hand. You know? Because it just makes no sense. Because nothing in the game has you traversing anything going downwards ever. Except for this one part that you come to late in the game. And then you're just kind of left to figure it out.
And if you fail. Yeah, if you fail, it's instant death.
Yep. Do 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 do. Like,
you get the little cinema scene.
Yeah. Well, you get the whole screen flashes.
Oh yeah.
The weird screen flashing, which I don't really understand. But
it's perfect. I don't understand.
It's kind of a last laugh, but
it's trying to give you a seizure to go with your cheap death.
But mm-hmm. the dickishness of this game is just legendary. Like, if anyone wants to try their hand at this game, know that if you die against the final boss, instead of starting over at the beginning of that level as you usually do, you start over like the level before that.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it takes you actually all the way back to 6-1, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And bear in mind, all the way through the game, that rule never applies.
No. Nope.
You're always like, if you die in 5-2 or 5-3,
surprise. Yes.
Yeah, it's completely out of nowhere. You're like, wait a minute. And they just did that to make it artificially harder, so.
Yeah. And how many forms does the final boss have again? Like two or three?
This isn't even my final form.
Yeah.
I don't even remember. That's the thing. It's been interesting. Yeah. That's the thing. The one thing I do like about it, though, is that really you can kind of predict after a while. The thing is, I will say the enemy placement, it's the same every time. So, I mean, you know, you wind up dying a bunch of times, but you figure out exactly where the enemies are. You figure out their timing. You figure out when they appear. And you can almost get down. You can get it down like clockwork. So you can just, like, once you get experience, you can just bust through areas of the game. I mean, it's just, you can do it really quickly. But every once in a while, you run into something. You're just like, what the hell?
Oh, yeah. There's a, there's one of those YouTube videos where somebody had a little gameplay AI that learned how to play the game by just repeating actions over and over again until it got something that worked.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, A, it got really good at the game, and B, it did some completely insane stuff the game designers never designed for it to do.
That's
like
awesome.
Jumping and then turning and hitting and then kind of going back down. It's like, what in the world are you doing, game?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it does sort of give away how... I mean, really, a lot of what this game does is it gives away what making a game was like back then. I mean, you have these enemies that have effectively zero AI whatsoever. I mean, the bosses, they literally are just in series. They do one attack, they do the next attack, they move here, they attack, they move here, they attack.
Yeah.
You have enemies that basically just fly in a path from the same spot every time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, this game is considered a classic, but honestly, after playing it now, I don't really think it's actually very good.
You know what? I kind of agree with you. When I tried to play it like last week, I was, this is so non-enjoyable. And just like a year or two before, I was really enjoying the fact that I finally beat the game. So I don't know what changed, but I found myself this time revisiting it. I did not want to finish this.
I think the drive to finally beat that game was rose-colored glasses-ing the under current of what is just really, really old and broken gameplay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I know this game is going to have somebody who writes a letter to, this is the best game ever, shut up. But, I mean, it really didn't age well.
I'm writing that letter right now.
A lot of the games from that era, especially in that style where they were just designed to be brutally difficult, really don't age well.
Well, it's interesting because, when you think of the classic 2D platformers of that time period, this game does not remind me of that. What this game reminds me of is Russian Attack. You remember that game? That game is so cheeseball.
You get out right now, John.
It's so hard, but just because it's so cheap, and that's what this game reminds me of. It reminds me of just, it's just
so
endless waves of cheap enemies that basically exploit the fact that you either can't compensate for where they are or you can't hit them at the right angle. You know what I mean? Like, it's just that kind of cheap stuff where, like, you never had a chance anyways.
That sounds like Castlevania NES to me as well, but...
A bit, yeah.
I
think I enjoy Castlevania more, though.
Yeah, Castlevania, I always felt like I had more of a fighting chance.
So John and I know are firmly in the pro camp here, but, like, would you say these games, like Ghosts and Goblins, feel more like a platformer of that era, or would they feel kind of... Because there is a lot of that. The enemy just spawns literally under your foot. Have fun with this.
That's the thing. I think that they're a bit less robotic than this is.
I mean, the thing is, the bosses certainly are. I mean, the bosses are... But that's because the bosses don't really move. They kind of just hover in place and just lob big area of effect attacks at you.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like as a player, you kind of have more control of the pace of the game.
Yeah, that's true, because you're controlling
the something like Ghouls and Ghosts. I just find myself, kind of just playing through it, and I'm just sort of like, this is not really that great a platformer. I mean, I think it was probably at the time better than most stuff out there, but it just kind of shows you that outside of Mario games at that time, platformers were probably pretty crappy.
Does that mean that I had good taste back then? Because I never really enjoyed ever playing Castlevania or Ninja Gaiden as a kid. I'd like play these games at friends' houses and just say, no, I don't like this.
Yeah, probably. But that's,
I mean, at least like both games are really easy on the ears. And
Yeah. Absolutely.
Sure. I mean,
it helps.
I think they are important games before they are good games.
So, I mean, I'm enjoying it. I can't say I'm not enjoying it, but I kind of see it more sort of for what it is now rather than before where I was like, oh my God. You know, I mean, like, this is one of those games that, I had to have. I loved it in the arcade. and I had to have it for NES, and, you know, I bought it as soon as it came out, and I was like, this is amazing, it was so difficult at the time. But now I play it, I'm just like, it's okay. I mean, it's good, but it's not great.
Right.
Yeah.
So
its place in history is more important than the ability to return to it and enjoy it as an experience.
I think it's probably more to do with how they present it than anything else. I think at the time that was more groundbreaking than the gameplay.
Probably. Mm-hmm. All right, so we're going to go ahead and wrap up the new business what are we at?
You got to talk.
Yeah, we've got, I know I am. I was just thinking how much time we have left. We have a ton of time for new business, so that's good. I'm going to go next, and I am going to discuss the first PS3 game I didn't buy the first PS3 game I bought that wasn't Kusuge, which is really what you should buy all your games as, but I broke my own rule and went ahead and bought what people have been emailing the show literally since the Ogre Battle episode, telling me I need to play Valkyria Chronicles.
Yay.
So I got it a couple days ago. I'm through 9 chapters, so I don't know how far I am into the game. I haven't checked to see how long it is. Hopefully I'm not that far into it, but
yeah, James. By the way, James, I'm hoping that your words here will inspire me to actually take the shrink wrap off.
You know what? You know what? I can't laugh here because I'm in the same situation.
Oh God! Oh,
there
God.
Is another.
You guys had like a 4-year head start on the console.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but games were coming out like every week.
Not 4 years ago for the PS3.
There's a lot of games out there, James. A lot of games.
Anyway,
so James, I mean, I know that Johnny talked about this previously, and I think I watched him play it for a bit. It's a beautiful game.
It's gorgeous. It's unbelievably beautiful, and it's got this. It is an anime style game, but they layered this effect over it that gives it sort of this hand shading that makes that it gives detail to shadow and shape and gives everything this roundness that really just looks like it was drawn by an artist sitting there by hand.
And yeah, some people would say like it's cel shading, but it's not, right? Like it's more of a kind of a crayon look.
It's. I mean, you're kind of equivocating at that point. To me, what makes it work is it's even without the effects, it's a beautiful game just artistically. Mm-hmm. Like the character design, the world design, you know, even things like how they. What they design weapons to look like. It's all very well executed, well thought out. It's very stylized. But then with the layering of this sort of filter that makes it look kind of like a hand-drawn sketch, it kind of adds this second dimension of just, you know, shape to it. It makes everything feel more organic, more alive, even though at the same time it makes it more artificial looking. It's a very weird kind of place to put yourself, but it is absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially when it gets into the full motion videos, and it's just the action sequences they do for the full motion videos are unbelievable. I mean, they are the quality you could produce a television show at.
But in the gameplay, it is a strategy game.
It is. So it's, well, kind of. So the closest analog that I could come up with is Battalion Wars. But it's not a great analog because this is turn-based versus Battalion Wars, which is, it is turn-based.
Real-time.
Semi-real-time.
I have not played this game. I mean, like I said, I watched Johnny play 2 or 3 missions of it. Mm-hmm. The structure in some weird way actually reminded me of Quest 64, if that makes sense.
Awesome.
Where you kind of have, you have a turn and you can move a certain amount in that turn.
Yep.
And Quest 64 was like a bounded range you can move.
Yeah, it was like a big circle around
you. But in this game, I think it's more of like a how much you can walk, right?
Right. If you ran around in a circle, you would expire all your energy.
Right. So there's a certain so it really is similar. Like Fire Emblem, you can move certain number of spots.
Right.
But it's not a grid based thing.
It's open world. Yeah. So you can run. Like I said, you could do laps and then you'd have exhausted yourself versus most games, which is, it's just an absolute position distance from where you are.
Yeah.
You can get this far from where you started. So.
So yeah, you have a gauge that you can exhaust. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
So how the game works is every turn you start, you have an encounter, you're given a really, really, sometimes just totally bereft of detail mission summary of what's going on. You're given some basic intel and you get this map and it's, usually a crude map. It's not very detailed. You're trying to make out lay of the land from it, trying to plot out strategy on it. And then you have individual spots you can put a fixed number of units on. So you have different classes of unit. You know, you have scouts, which have a lot of distance and kind of ho-hum firepower, but they can move really far. You have, you know, you have kind of a medium infantry unit that has a high rate of fire, kind of middling accuracy. They can't move that far, but they take a lot of abuse. They do a lot of abuse. You have, you know, anti-mechanized units. They're referred to as Lancers. They have fixed ammunition limits, but they're really good against shooting up tanks and useless against anything else for the most part. You have like a sniper, which is exactly what it sounds like. Limited ammunition, almost no movement range, but can shoot clear across the battlefield and just take people out with headshots. And I mean, and then you have like tanks and stuff like that. So there's these different classes you kind of have to juggle and figure out their individual strengths and weaknesses. And what
I forget, in this game, can you not see enemies unless like you're within a certain range?
So it's all about establishing line of sight. So what happens is, as your units move about the map and you position them, and as you go through levels, where they're looking and what obstacles are in their way, things like altitude, you know, geography, trees, stuff like that, will give them, you know, basically a cone of vision. And if there are enemies in that cone of vision, they call out, they see the enemy, and then that enemy shows up on your map. Right. If the enemy moves outside their cone of vision, you lose sight of them. So primarily, the only real mechanism you have for understanding the battlefield as a whole is what you take between moves. So what happens is you pick a character from your map, and you're looking at the same map as before, and it's just got little icons where all your characters are, where all the known enemy characters are, and then like position of last report. So if there's an enemy that you knew where they were at one point, but you've lost sight of them, there's a little marker indicating that there was an enemy here at one point, we've lost track of where they went. And it gives you kind of the idea where your objective is and where you are. But it's a crude map, and the only thing that you have is that to work off. So when you take control of a unit, you click on their icon, and then you expire or use some of your movement points to take over that character and then direct them for a fixed amount of action. So there's movement and attacks, essentially. And that you can do one attack, and then they can move a certain distance. That's really where you get a feel for the geography of the landscape, sort of, at a ground level. So you're constantly trying to balance what you're seeing broadly. That is me this time with the buzz. Oh, stops. You're trying to balance what you see broadly when you look at the map with what these little snippets of the world you've seen from when you take over your characters. And you're just sort of trying to piece that information together to come up with the best strategy to just clear the mission quickly. And a lot of times that means the game doesn't give you enough information, or you're stuck trying to just drudge through what is ultimately the wrong decision, and then you have to go back and replay it. What I found is a lot of times the game's tactics are really conducive to a singular way of solving the mission. And I say that because in the current mission, one of the ones I just beat today, mission 7, I think, I was stuck on it for a while, and it's this giant-ass tank that you can't hurt. It just tools around the level and just shoots stuff. And the only way you can hurt it is to knock down things in the environment blocking its path. So it has to fire its primary gun to clear the path so it can continue. And that opens up these ports that you can then toss grenades down to hurt it. But at no point have you ever tossed grenades down a hole. You have to climb up a ladder to get to it. Things covered in machine guns. There's all kinds of weird stuff going on that you have to work with here. And I ultimately just watched someone play it because I didn't realize I could toss grenades into the thing. I didn't realize that scouts could climb it. And as I'm watching how this person plays, I can see, oh, there's like a second set of tactics here that I've never even played with before. And it's a lot of just learning as you go in this game. So what I've found is that a lot of times I'll alternate between mission. I just sort of brute force it, or I find the path to clear it really quickly, and mission where I sit there and I go, oh my God, what am I doing? Oh, what's going wrong? And it's a tough balance to deal with, but at the same time, it can be rewarding when you finally do solve it. Conversely, it can be really frustrating when you go on YouTube and see that there's just some dumb hack way to beat this level. And you go, oh, great. Awesome. Thanks, game. It is a constant. I mean, the game itself, it's a weird mix of just RPG and tactics and action combats. It's when you control the enemy, or when you control your unit, you basically are literally controlling their aim and shooting, but then there's the random dice rolls to determine how accurate they are. And, you know, you have a ring, like a ring that says their shot will hit somewhere in this ring. So if you're closer, obviously, you're more likely to get headshots, which are instant kills, versus if you're far away, where you're more likely to spread out your shots. And, you know, you can sneak up, you can use your direct control to actually move around obstacles to hide from enemies and sneak up behind them. So there's a lot of action stuff in here. It's a lot of stealth combat, really, is what comes up. There's a lot of just basically getting behind somebody and walking right up behind them and shooting them. And then there's a lot of putting your forces in position so that can't happen to them. Because as you approach enemies, they fire on you. So it's this weird balance of trying to plan out, you know, one or two moves ahead while working with a relatively limited information set and trying to expand that information set as quickly as you can. It gives the game a nice, it can give the game a nice pace, but it can also make it feel like you're not sure if the game's going to reward you for being really aggressive or really conservative. And most strategy games, you get a feel for that relatively early. Does this game want you to be aggressive or conservative? Is that how it works? A lot of this game, it feels like they want you to be aggressive, but because a lot of the characters that can do things that are special, that your sort of tool for this specific situation is really slow, you know, if it's anything but a scout, basically, you sort of have to be conservative while being aggressive at the same time. It's really kind of an interesting mental hurdle to get through.
But it still feels like you're developing a strategy, right? Like
you absolutely are developing a strategy. Like you're doing both. You're solving the puzzle of the strategy.
Okay, but no, but I mean, like, sometimes these games can feel like there's one solution, and you gotta find it.
So, there's a good mission that, for this, is there's a mission where your forces start split in half, and you're working through a wood. And there's an enemy base at the end, and there are patrols just sort of wandering around. So, there's three paths you can take, although one of the paths is kind of hidden. But the two primary paths, you can advance up the paths and then get into a slugging match with their tanks at the end of the trail and maybe slip a unit behind them and achieve the objective. But I found that to be really difficult. When I found this third path, sort of exploring the level, because it wasn't super clearly marked on the map, I was able to sort of get behind the enemy more easily. So in a sense, finding that third path is kind of a puzzle. But there are strategies you can employ. You know, a diversionary attack on the front versus a counter attack on the side that are tactical as well. So there usually is the game never puts you in a situation that I've seen where it's just like, hey, fuck you, have fun. But there's usually a something the game is giving you in the map that if you see it and you act on it, you have, you know, a substantially easier time. But with the exception of this giant tank where you literally had to put somebody on the tank to kill it, I haven't encountered a situation where you really have to move the pieces the way the game wants you to. Mm. And that level really felt like a one-off. Like they were saying, this is a special event, you know, you're going to do this one time and that's it.
Okay. And like the game has, I think, like XCOM, the characters, the units gain experience. Do you find yourself restarting when you lose a unit?
So, I actually like how they handle this. There's two things here. You collect experience for battle, and you can do these skirmishes, which are old battlefields you've already cleared before, and they let you sort of experiment with new tactics by doing that, because you already know the map, so you can sort of play with things. But you're given a big lump of experience at the end of every battle, and it's just the collective. It's based on what you killed, what you did, the level base, how fast you did it, that kind of stuff. And then you go to this, between levels, you go to this thing called the training field, and you apportion out your experience based on classes. And what happens is every member of that class levels up. So if you pump in enough experience, all your scouts will level up, all your engineers will level up. So right now I'm keeping everybody the same, but if I find that I'm starting to lean towards, you know, these assault units, I might start pumping up their level more than the others. The additional thing is, while units can die, and there is finality in death. In fact, there's a part of the game called the graveyard where you can visit their grave sites. Just them reaching zero HP isn't enough to kill them. That essentially incapacitates them. Then it's just a race for you to get to them and get them evacuated before the enemy gets to them. So there is a way out. And thankfully, although I didn't find it out until the stupid tank level, you can actually save in mission and restart from a save point. So if you make progress and then something goes really wrong, you can just reload it and try again. So that might have saved me a lot of headaches early on playing this game. But there's the game's not super punishing, and there is a ton of units to use. And, I mean, you can only keep 20 in the party, and I've got another 15 just sitting in the base I can't use right now. But it's, you know, every unit is different. Every unit has a personality. Every unit has a backstory. Every unit has environmental things, like they are, you know, they don't like to get dirty. So if you're in a muddy area, they're going to perform really badly. Or they're like farmers, so they perform really well in meadows, stuff like that. Or they don't get along with certain characters, so you kind of have to manage who they're around. Or they get along really well, so you want to sort of push them together. I mean, there's lots of these little individual performance modifiers that I haven't even really gotten to plumbing the depths of yet. So it feels like there's a lot of depth here that I'm really getting, just starting to get my hands around. So I'm looking forward to doing that. It's a fun game, but it's taken some time to get where I need to get so far.
Hmm. And I guess something worth mentioning for Nintendo fans is that there's some sort of tie-in with what's it called?
Skies of Arcadia. Yeah, so Vis and Ika are characters in your party, although I don't have Ika right now. But I do have Vis, and he is a badass. He's amazing. And his stats are great, because his skills are like courageous leader, bravery on the front, and it's just like all these things. I'm like, yeah, Sega really wants us to know. No, we still love this character, honest.
Yeah, it's like, okay, this stat is exactly what you need.
Yeah, basically.
It's amazing, and exactly what you're looking for is also amazing for this character.
Oh, and
yeah, well, the I can't remember the name of the director, but she made also, well, Skies of Arcadia, of course, but also the Phantasy Star games, I believe.
Oh.
I'm not that up on my Sega knowledge, I guess, but yeah, I think that was her last great console game was Valkyria Chronicles, and yep. Then she got relegated to making whatever crap Sega has her do.
Like, well, I mean, right now the Valkyria Chronicles games are on PSP.
Right.
Yep.
Valkyria Chronicles 3 actually didn't come out in the U.S. because 2 didn't sell well because it was on the PSP.
Yeah, no doubt, right?
So Sega's like, well, it didn't sell well. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
What's funny, though, is the characters in Project Crosszone from this franchise are the PSP Valkyria Chronicles 3 characters, which were never in a game outside of Japan because Sega. Because they're not the characters most familiar for fans of this franchise. They're the ones least familiar. Way to be, Sega. Way
Good
to
job.
Be.
Good job. Good to see.
Great job, Sega. But yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I don't know how long it is. I don't know how much I've got left in this game. I assume I've got some real distance. I'm only through chapter 9. There's these unlockable chapters you can buy that give you backstory on characters, which I'm absolutely loving. I had a little heart attack when I saw Vis was in my party. I was like, And it's just been, a challenging, sometimes frustrating. Sometimes it feels like the game doesn't give you enough intelligence and your intelligence division must be terrible. But at the same time, rewarding experience when you get stuff going and things are working and the mission's going and, you know, you found the key to this level and you just hit them where it hurts. It's a great feeling. And the fact you can control your units to do it just makes it feel, you feel more connected with the battle. I'm really enjoying it. So, Guillaume, did you want to talk Saints Row 3? Because I love me some Saints Row 3. We can talk some Saints Row 3.
I guess the only thing I have to say is that this game is not for everyone.
Oh.
You might get the opposite impression if you listen to Johnny and James, but there are some things that I like. I found that the humor kind of fell flat for me. Like, I'm not offended by this game. It tries really, really hard to be not really offensive, but really, like, over the top.
It tries really hard to be dumb.
Yeah. And over the top, and yeah, a little bit offensive, because you've got, like, the last story mission that I did had me rescuing this guy from this dominatrix thing. Like, he was a gimp. He was like, he had a ball gag in his mouth and he was pulling a cart.
Yes, he was. And you were riding that cart having a shootout.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. So see,
nonsensical,
like,
but you know.
Yeah.
I get why this is funny, but at the same time, I don't know, I felt like the game is trying too hard. One of the main aspects that I really loved and that I did not get from games like GTA 4 was the pure mayhem that can happen when you just start shooting people or driving around.
Oh, yeah.
I really love how once you start like getting into a shootout with an enemy gang, the guy that you're shooting at might get, you know, mowed down by some random driver.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, like
it's just
chaos. Like someone crashes into him. It's just like, oh, okay, that was a freebie.
Yeah.
And there's a type of mission in the game that I love, and it's the insurance fraud type of mission.
Oh, yeah.
And it has you basically hurl yourself at cars so that you can, you know, get the insurance money.
And you get like a bonus for hitting multiple cars.
Yeah, and it's got like ragdoll physics, and so you just get bumped from car to car to car. It's a little bit similar to the crash mode and burnout and stuff like that. And I thought that was just hilarious. And there's a couple of lines, like some cop came up to me and said, "Your reign of terror is over, Satan." That was pretty damn hilarious. But eventually, I don't know, like I played a little bit last night and I was like, okay, I think I've had my fill of this game and I'm ready to move on to something else. The story doesn't grip me and I don't know.
The story is the game's weakest part and also its funniest part because it just doesn't care.
Yeah.
I mean there are points in the story where you can tell they're just like, fuck, I don't care. Like,
yeah.
Yep, you're in a video game now, deal with it. It's like the characters will talk about how they're in a video game and how it feels like they're in a video game even when they're not in a video game. It's like, how self-aware are you right now, game? Because
well,
I'm not
yeah.
entirely sure if you're self-aware or really unself-aware.
Well, that's the thing, like that's part of the game's charm, right? Is because then that's part of a riff on GTA taking itself so seriously,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
That's definitely what I appreciate about it. The mm-hmm. only GTA game I've played is 4. And it was just boring. It was like,
yeah,
it was kind of the city simulation that's really well done, but that I didn't care about. And here it's just, you're let loose and you can do missions in any order. You know, you kind of unlock them on the map when you
right.
do the related story mission. But mm-hmm. even if you don't do the story missions, you can do them at all times. You just don't know what they are before you get to them.
No.
Yeah. So it's just like complete freedom. And so, yeah, it's fun for a while. It's an actual sandbox game.
I do like that they are promoting the DLC for Saints Row 4. On the release of GTA 5, they've started calling it the main gang, or the leader of the Saints gang's name is Gat, G-A-T.
Yeah. Johnny Gat, right?
Yeah, so they were promoting it as GAT 5, the 5 DLC packs of Johnny Gat. And like they splashed it all over Steam on the launch day of GTA 5. It's like they're fully aware this game is, by and large, lives and dies by trolling the GTA series.
Yeah, in a way it just shows you how big, you know, Grand Theft Auto is because Pretty much a hit game can be made completely off of spoofing Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
How ridiculous is that?
It is. It's like the scary movies of the Grand Theft Auto series.
Yeah.
But they're actually kind of funny sometimes.
Yeah, and it's actually become a hit series into itself. It's bizarre.
I will say, in terms of the mayhem, my favorite moment, because I actually pulled it out the other day, just to kind of piss around town, my favorite moment is, I'm not doing anything, I'm just standing there, and a cop runs up and just starts just... You know, he's saying all these harassing things. I'm not even touching the control. I'm just sitting there. And then he punches me. And then I'm suddenly wanted because he punched me.
Oh, nice.
But see, I've got infinite health. I can't be hurt because I've max leveled up. So he just keeps punching me and then he starts shooting me and my wanted level goes up. And then a police helicopter shows up because I'm clearly on a crime spree standing perfectly still. And somehow or another, the police helicopter clipped the side of a building, crashed into the ground and wiped out everything. I was like, I didn't do anything.
You're just a malevolent force. Your presence just causes this stuff.
He's like trying to get a shot off on me. He comes around and clips the corner. No, I didn't touch the controller. It's vibrating across the table, freaking out while this stuff's going on.
That's awesome.
I do love that the game has made bad AI a feature.
Oh, yeah, because the AI is dreadful, but in the most amazing ways. Like, trucks driving backwards because they got stuck in the park. You just like walk and there's a semi in the park. You're like, how'd this even get here? And it's driving in circles backwards because it can't get out. And you're like, oh my God, this is so bad. Or you'll stop a car, another car will plow into that car, and then another car plows into that, and it just keeps going. Like, eventually it might stop, or you might end up with a pile of 100 cars. And you're like, it happens. Just because I jaywalked and caused a 500 car pileup.
That's awesome.
This game was one of the PlayStation Plus free games that I got. That kind of makes them disposable. Like, I did not go back to Sleeping Dogs after talking about it. And Sleeping Dogs also kind of took itself seriously. And once you've experienced the combat, you're like, okay, that was good combat in a GTA game, and there's no more reason to play this.
Yeah.
I'm probably not going to go back to Saints Row 3, and I'm going to move on to Just Cause 2, probably.
Oh, guys, you've got a theme going, don't you?
I guess I'm in that kind of mood, but...
Crime. You've turned to a life of video game crime, Guillaume.
Guillaume's a virtual thug.
These repressed... tendencies, these repressed desires to play violent video games, and all I got is a Wii U.
There you go. And on that note, we're going to go ahead and wrap up new business, and when we come back, it'll be time for... Well, we've got some topics to talk about, and maybe some listener mail. Stay tuned.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Nintendo World Report staff discusses the recent PlayStation Vita TV announcement in a roundtable format. And what does that mean for Nintendo? Is the Nintendo 2DS doomed? Is it stiff competition for the Wii U? See what the staff thinks in this feature.
Next, we have a preview of Etrian Odyssey Untold, The Millennium Girl by Justin Baker. Discover how this remake of the first Etrian Odyssey title keeps the crunchy, hardcore role-playing core... Wow, who wrote this? Of the series, and adds to it...
Now you see how hard it is.
Of the series, and adds to it a much-needed ongoing plot involving actual characters. Can't stop progress.
All right, and we have a review of The Legend of Zelda The Wind Waker HD by Neil Ronahan. Neil reacquaints himself with this revered title and clues us in on whether or not it's worth replaying. Has it aged well? Read Neil's review and find out. And we also have A Storied History of Rune Factory by Kimberly Keller. Curious about the Rune Factory series? Kimberly Keller sits down and tells you everything that you ever need to know about the series. Get your Rune Factory information right here in this detailed synopsis.
I think everything you need to know is summarized in my attempts to review Rune Factory Frontier, chronicled in like episodes 86 to 99.
Jeez.
It went on for a long time. We also have impressions this week of Pokemon X and Pokemon Y on 3DS by Josh Max and Justin Berbe. Josh and Justin got some time with Pokemon X and Y and dive into some of the more minor improvements this entry has to offer. We also have a feature, Kickstarter Watch, Mighty No. 9, the modern homage to Platform Legend by Tom Molina. Capcom is not known to be litigious about fan devotionals, but let's see what they do when one of their own makes a game based on the classic Capcom franchise, Onimusha. Tom gives us a look at the crowd-funded robot action game that's now funded through a Wii U port. That'll close off. Yeah, all this and more at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Awesome.
We're back, and it's time for listener mail, but not really, because we're going to start with something else besides listener mail this week. So it was announced today that Nintendo's fourth president, the man responsible for moving them into the video game industry altogether, Hiroshi Yamauchi, passed away at the age of 85. So we wanted to, briefly give some background on Mr. Yamauchi's contributions to the company, who he was as a person, and ultimately, if we have any thoughts about what he did. Ultimately, his decision to take them out of the playing card business is kind of why we're here right now.
Sort of, a little bit.
It's kind of weird to say that, but if they were still making playing cards, we probably wouldn't be having a podcast about them.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, certainly, obviously a huge part of the company. And just a very interesting story, because he really wasn't... he famously never played games in his life.
Nope.
And but yet he was tasked with overseeing, and actually, I mean, he had very strict control over the company and every single game that was produced for it. And he was the ultimate judge and jury on whether or not a game idea would be gamelit, would be greenlit and gamelit.
Well, I mean, when you say he was tasked with it, I mean, he tasked himself with it. That was his decision.
Yeah.
Basically, like, he would have the developer bring the game that they had been working on for months and play it in front of him. And, yeah, basically, on whatever he said, okay, this is good, then the game would go on. And if he didn't like it, then you had to stop working on it. It was just like,
much.
It's final. Goodbye.
Yeah, so to give some even earlier background, he was made president of the company at, like, what, 23 or 24? He hadn't even finished college yet, and
I don't know. I've got this book, History of Nintendo, and apparently he was very, very he liked living the good life. He was away from his grandparents and who raised him in Kyoto. He was in Tokyo, and there he was just using his family fortune to go eat steaks while everyone was starving during the war. And he was boozing it up, and
yeah, but, I mean, now this is of course Japan post World War II. It's not exactly the greatest place on the planet to be.
And then, so when he actually, the condition on him coming back to run the company after his grandfather had a stroke was that they fired all the rest of his family.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to be the only member of the Yamauchi family working at that company, and they did it, which tells you a lot about how Japanese companies were run then. That it was so important that a family member take over the company.
Yep.
Like before him, the whole series of directors were arranged marriages, and the grandfather only had daughters, so he arranged a marriage with some guy from his company with his daughter, and this guy became a Yamauchi by
through that
arrangement.
He adopted the name.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then went on to direct the company.
Yeah. It's a Japanese business culture is very weird. if you can't figure that one out on your own. But I mean, he did a lot of things to move the company forward. I don't know. I mean, TRP, you might have actually played Hanafuda before.
No.
It's dull and it's complicated. And the only reason you would really find to play it is for gambling. And
right.
In fact, that was what card games were in Japan at that time. They were, you know, mechanisms for gambling.
Right. So is this where the whole Yakuza connection thing goes back to?
I'm sure that Nintendo, who was producing Hanafuda cards on paper, actually, at the time, was selling them to members of the Yakuza because they didn't involve themselves in illegal gambling.
Right.
I don't know that there was some great connection. It was just, we make cards, you buy cards.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I doubt they were having them in for steak dinners.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, again, Japanese organized crime is also kind of weird. So who knows? But I mean, the first thing that Yamauchi did when he took over was he converted the cards to plastic, which makes them A, more durable, and B, you can also charge more for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then B, he signed a licensing agreement with Disney to make these, so he could make these card games for the family to get them out of this relatively seedy world of gambling, which is obviously a relatively limited field, and try to get them into a broad spectrum of homes.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way of mass marketing their product, and B, targeting the party environment, which sort of continues on now, even as you look at what Nintendo does as a product, how they target their marketing.
Yeah, you know, broad audiences, characters that appeal to everybody. You know, you can kind of see the seeds of the modern Nintendo being sown there.
Yeah. And ultimately, there's a story about him traveling to the biggest card manufacturer in the world, which was in Cincinnati, of all places, to see...
Was that Topps or some company like that?
I guess it must have been.
Yeah.
And he was just trying to get a feel for how to expand their business. And when he got there, he was so unimpressed, he realized, we have to get out of the card business.
Yeah.
And after a series of ridiculous ventures.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that.
By all means, Guillaume. I'm not really prepared to go through them, so.
At first, like, he wanted to get out of the entertainment business. His logic was that people don't need entertainment, so it's
right.
It's just...
That sounds so much like him. Oh my god! Mm-hmm.
Well, but, I mean, but, if you're selling a need versus a want, you have a captive audience.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So he first turned his side towards different types of like food. Like I think that instant food was getting popular, so he bought like this plant to make instant rice. And that didn't turn out very well. And then he moved on to buying a taxi company. And he had so much trouble with the employees and the unions and things like that. And eventually, he just sold all his shares to some other company. Like, it was just too much trouble. And I'm guessing that with his kind of, you know, iron fist style leadership, yeah, like I would assume that unions would cause a problem.
Oh, he very famously, when he took over Nintendo as a playing card company, he didn't, because he was so young, he didn't have the respect of the employees. He very famously broke a strike by just firing all the employees on strike.
Yeah.
He's just like, you're gone. I'm done. Mm-hmm. That's, again, Japanese business culture.
Yeah.
You can get away with that.
Yeah.
I mean, he ran his company. That's his iron fist.
Mm-hmm. And from taxis, I think the logical jump is to go into love hotels. And
I think that's about fair, actually.
Talk about wants versus needs. You
know, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much how the evening goes.
Hey, he was back in the entertainment business, baby.
Yeah.
He was facilitating.
Entertaining with sailors.
Just in case listeners don't know what love hotels are, it's a very Japan thing. And
sadly it isn't.
Well, yeah, but I think that they have a little bit more, like they're a little bit better regarded.
To call them by such a respectable name is very Japanese.
Now, are they actually brothels though?
No, they are not.
Yeah.
No, they purport to be, kind of for couples, right?
Right.
You're Japanese and you live in a cramped space and you get no
with your parents
intimacy.
Yeah, I mean, you live there with the grandparents of the house.
Yeah. So what do? You go to a love hotel for a couple of hours.
Yep. It's hotels that you pay for by the hour.
Yeah. And so the love hotel venture also was not successful, and the papers at the time kind of made fun of the fact that it was probably still a good deal for him because he probably saved a lot by going there.
Nice,
yeah,
perfect, good for him. Mm. I'm look, more power to him. You know?
Bravo, bravo, love hotels by Yamauchi, bravo.
Now, I'm not so much bravo into love hotels, just him personally.
Mm-hmm.
Good work, sir. But I mean, yes, yeah, so he went through this really kind of insane series of businesses, and then ultimately he just sort of got lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Pun not intended, given the current conversation. he just happened across an employee who, on his break, that eventually we'll know as Gunpei Yokoi, who had built this little toy to play with on his free time, that ultimately became the Ultra Hand.
Right.
This little claw grabber that he had just built out of scrap pieces. And he basically said, oh, if we can get the toys, you know, go ahead and try to, they basically went and productionalized this toy and were incredibly successful in doing so. At which point, Yokoi was put in charge of product development. And he made things like the Love Tester and some other, you know, that light gun, that actual freaking ass light gun projector that mm-hmm. is worth a ton of money right now. I wish I'd bought one when I had a chance. And and ultimately that led to the point of them deciding to make a video game system.
And I guess one of the better business decisions that he made was actually to give free reins to Gunpei Yokoi and to develop, you know, Nintendo to develop their own games. Because up until then, they had already you know, put their toes in the toy business, but they were licensing games. You just can't sell too much that way.
Yeah, they were like making ports of or clones of one or two games, I think, for the arcade.
Yeah, like they licensed the game Twister, and it was it failed horribly because Japanese people
it's
are
a clone of Twister.
Japanese people were not, you know, very inclined to put themselves in that kind of situation in public in front of her friends.
Yeah,
but yeah, once Gunpei Yokoi started working on these toys that really became hits. Like the Ultra Hand sold over 1 million.
Which is so ridiculous. It's just a little claw hand.
It is. And then like this kind of baseball pitcher thing, which sold over 2 million because kids in Japan were so in love with the sport, baseball. So these huge hits that up until then, Nintendo had been in trouble financially, and those hits just gave them, put them back in the back, you know, like.
And it gave them a direction. I mean, it gave them a guide to being profitable, to being a successful company. It said, this is what we can produce. And ultimately, it started moving them towards making their own arcade machines. Mm-hmm. And really, it moved the experience making these clones that they had built, mm-hmm. which were just clones of popular games from Western markets. It sort of guided his philosophy that you can make successful video games, but you really can't let the engineers make them because they're just going to copy things that already exist.
Yeah.
And that was when he decided to put, you know, he and Yokoi decided it was important to put artists in charge of making their games. And that's ultimately how they came across.
Yeah. And I mean, and also kind of just the fact that, you know, if you just get the right idea at the right time, it can catch fire. Like you don't,
right.
You know, like you can catch it in a bottle, sort of, so to speak.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and you have to just work that, basically, and know when it's time to move on to the next thing.
Yep.
Right. And to never do, basically, what the competition is doing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, it really, the stuff that he did with the decision to make the Famicom, which he famously boasted was going to sell 2 million units in the first year, you know, he made a couple decisions on it based on what he saw with the pre-crash systems, which is it needed to be easy to program for. You need to be able to produce color on it, and you need to be able to afford it. Mm-hmm. And that was it. The Famicom was built off those three things, and ultimately it was easy to program for, which meant you could make games, and ultimately he recognized that having games is what would make his product successful. Which, I mean, it really is sort of the fundamentals of what was going to be the modern video game console manufacturing business being formed at that moment.
Yep.
Because if you look at how, you know, Bushnell ran his company, just how, you know, Atari and Television, all those companies were run. They weren't run like companies are run now. They were producing an electronic device, and if you made a game for it, bully for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, they weren't designed to be. They were just designed to be a thing that had an APU and some memory.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm surprised that, you know, Nintendo was the one to kind of have that revelation, because Japanese, maybe it wasn't the case back then, but I tend to think that Japanese are more focused on hardware than software. They tend to latch on to robots and things like that, and they're not as, historically, they just aren't as strong in the actual software field.
They latch on to robots, but they also latch on to the AI that makes them human.
That's true.
I mean, it's this weird concept of understanding the synthesis of what, you know, the software and hardware need to do together. But I think ultimately to him, it wasn't even that complicated. It was just what adds value to your system to make people mm-hmm. willing to spend the money to buy it? Well, having things to play on it.
Yeah. I'm sure he also saw too that there was value in people being able to get this experience in their home rather than having to go out to get it.
And you didn't have to pay, you know, your cut. The arcade business was super weird. A lot of the games, you rented the arcade system you sold the arcade to a manufacturer who then rented it to the person who had it in their store. And then a cut of that went back to the manufacturer. And then a cut of that went back to the developer. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, if you were the developer, you got a lump sum payment at the front and then these little small payments incrementally through the rest of the life cycle of the system.
Yeah.
And versus if you sell the game, you could cut out at least a good portion of the middleman, and that money comes to you. So to them, getting out of the arcade business was a pretty easy decision, because they weren't building their own arcade cabinets. They were using someone else's, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it worked out really well for them, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, as the company grew, he eventually, you know, we're talking about his iron fist. He actually made three R&D teams just so they could force them to compete against one another.
Yeah,
like, I actually like that idea, and I think
it is.
It's a good idea, but
it's so him.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are two things going on here that I feel like that was such a great idea, because one, back then and now, you know, Nintendo's doing its own thing. They don't necessarily feel like they're competing with the competition. They're doing their own thing, and so having internal competition forced them to be innovative. And come up with new ideas and And, you know, I just feel like, you know, kind of like what we were discussing last week or the week before about how there's been a bit of lethargic design or something at Nintendo mm-hmm. for the last year or a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's partially because there wasn't someone like Yamauchi saying, no, you guys need to be competing with each other and you know, make a new game or make something that's really going to sell a lot. Because if everyone's kind of doing the Miyamoto thing, for lack of a better term,
right.
All the games are kind of samey and there isn't so much. I mean, you could see it. You know, they weren't compelled to release a lot of games for a period of time. They felt like they could coast on stuff they'd already released. And that, I don't think that was something that Yamauchi would be okay with if he were still running the company at that point. I really don't.
Yeah. I would imagine that at the time when he was staging these grand unveils where he either killed your game or said, this is what everybody's going to work on now. I would imagine if you didn't show up with a product to one of those, you were as good as done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there certainly was an emphasis to have something ready to show at all times, even if you had your idea killed the last few goes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the idea of internally competing is, I mean, it forces you to be creative. It sort of can build, in terms of a team, it can sort of build a camaraderie. It can allow different silos of personalities to develop so you get different experiences. Mm-hmm. But it's such a him. I mean, that is the ultimate
Yamauchi
move.
Well, yeah, I mean,
move.
It's classic. It's like, you know, it's fear making people excel.
Yeah.
Really. And that was the way he rolled.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing... It works out really well when you think about it, but it is kind of like... Wow, he is going on some of the basest human emotions here.
Mm-hmm.
He's working these people.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I mean, he was around as president for how many years, Gil? I'm sure you've got it written down. Yeah. Which, if you think about it, is an eternity to be president of a company.
Yeah.
Because you figure you usually get the president of a company relatively late in your career, whereas he got there really early.
And the thing is, so many ebbs and flows in the market that he's trying to serve, right? I mean
– Right. Mm-hmm. Well, so by not having, they have investors and they have to answer to their investors, but the majority of the stock is held internally. So there wasn't going to be some grand investor uprising to replace him.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he was like a 10% stockholder at that point. I mean, 1/10 of the votes were his. And you have to figure a lot of the rest of the stock was vested around the Yamauchi family.
Mm-hmm.
So he was probably in good shape. He had originally, you know, it looked like he was going to do the Yamauchi thing and promote his son-in-law, Mr. Arakawa, but ultimately he ended up putting Iwata into the position of authority,
mm-hmm.
who had, they had only relatively recently moved out of HAL and moved internal. And Mr. Iwata made Mr. Yamauchi a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, made him the 12th richest person in Japan.
Yeah. See, one thing I've always been curious about is how that shift in power was taken in Japan. Like, how the Japanese press saw that. Because, you know, we always see that very, you know, we kind of get everything, you know, after the fact, secondhand kind of
right.
thing. I'm
yeah.
curious as to see what their reaction was. Because, you know, here it's, you know, when you know, somebody is named the new CEO, you know, it's picked apart. And I wonder how the Japanese press actually saw that. Like, you know, was Iwata seen as a good fit? You know, did they think that it was kind of a scandal that Arakawa was passed over? Like, yeah, that's the kind of stuff that I'd like to kind of see that story.
I mean, Arakawa had been sort of shelved at that point anyway.
Yeah.
I think ultimately it was probably the same reaction we had, which is a what? Because,
yeah.
I mean, Iwata had been – he'd been in the software planning division, I think, for like a year at that point. Not very long. He'd been head of it,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a position that's really a forward-facing position at the company.
Yeah.
It's an internal-facing division. It's basically doing what Yamauchi had been doing before with his approving games or killing games. I mean, that had essentially become Iwata's job.
Mm-hmm.
He was overseeing development of games that were going on at the company.
Yeah.
So putting him in power sort of makes sense, you know, organically.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, he had been running, I believe he'd been running some of the business ops at HAL, so he did have some experience, but that's a big transition.
Yeah. Perhaps they were looking at it from the standpoint of, hey, you know, business is sort of secondary to just having instincts, you know?
Right.
And I could see that's kind of an old school way of looking at things.
And his comments from when he retired to the press, basically, and he didn't make a lot of comments to the press.
Yeah.
His comments to the press basically were, I feel like the people that I've put in power are good enough that I don't need to worry about them anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that much about like Iwata's project management style, but I know recently I was reading a very old interview about the cancellation of Earthbound 64. Mm-hmm. And it was like kind of a round table with Iwata, I think Miyamoto, and and they really made it sound like, and they didn't really talk about it specifically, they really made it sound like Iwata had really good like project management skills or something, and he was able to kind of come in late in Earthbound's development, the second game's development, and kind of was able to focus the team and trim some of the fat and get an actual product shipped out. And I have to wonder if that and maybe some other similar experiences are what really got Yamauchi's attention. That he was able to kind of herd the cats and get something, you know, a quality product out.
I would think something like that would, to the kind of person he was, be really important to him. He could see that this is a person who understands the need to be focused, mm-hmm. who understands the needs of the company, who understands how to get a product to market that is a good product.
Yeah, and
works.
You know, part of that might also be the fact that maybe he was the one voice on that team where he wasn't really too swayed by what's going on around him. He said, this is the way it's going to be. We're going to do it like this. And even though other people, you might hear some chatter kind of around that, you know, right. Hey, you're doing this wrong. You should really, and you know, because, and I think about that. I think about Nintendo right now.
Like echo chamber.
That's right. Like Nintendo never.
He's like, look, guys, this has got to stop.
You know? Exactly.
This is how we need to run it.
Yeah.
This is,
and
I mean,
also believing in what they're doing. That
right.
might be something that he was looking for.
Yeah. I mean, there was certainly no doubt that Yokoi always believed in what he was doing.
Yeah.
I mean, the few comments he made are some of the most boisterous things you'll ever get out of a Japanese CEO.
Yeah.
Because they're usually, you know, buttoned down and reserved.
Yep. But that's
it's, so it's
yeah. I mean, some of the stuff that he would say would be downright arrogant.
Yeah, I mean, this is the guy who bought the Mariners.
Yeah.
More or less just cause.
Yeah, I mean, he's just.
I mean,
but he called it like he saw it though.
Yeah, he didn't care. He didn't like baseball.
Yeah.
But he bought just cause.
Yeah.
Like I mean, the reason they explained for buying the Mariners makes no sense, and it still doesn't make any sense, and yet they're still the primary investor in the team.
Yeah.
It continues to not make sense to this day. And Howard Lincoln is still there in the front office of that team. Mm-hmm. Which makes no sense at all. But sure enough, there he is. And Seattle fans hate him, but he's still there.
Yep.
So real quick, you know, he retired. He left Iwata as president. He stayed on the board for a couple more years before ultimately fully retiring. Which is probably kind of a training wheels period for Iwata, if I had to guess.
Yeah, he left. Mm-hmm. So he retired in 2002, and then he officially left the board, I believe, in 2005.
Yeah, and that he probably lets him slowly relinquish power.
Yep.
And sort of wean Iwata off of what his influence was.
And then you hear a lot though that people aren't sure if he really relinquished power.
Yeah,
the kind of person he was, I guess. Like,
yeah, if he had put Arakawa in charge, I would guarantee you he hadn't relinquished any power whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, with Iwata, it's kind of hard to tell because the company sort of zigged a little bit back to the toy route that they were on with the Wii and the DS. I mean, they're much more tactile experiences than just normal gaming consoles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I mean, maybe there was a little bit of self-reflection on the early successes of the company, and maybe he had a hand in those. I mean, obviously, Wii was in development when he was still there.
Yeah, Yamauchi does say that, like, he does take credit for the DS. He said,
"Oh, of course he does.
That's one of the last things." He said, "Oh, one of the last things I did before retiring was to tell them, like, have two screens." And so,
yeah.
I just wish I could be in that meeting. Two screens.
Yeah.
What?
Two screens. Two of them. And then he'll just drop the mic and just walk out.
Yeah.
It's just,
I'm going to go golfing.
He just tells
now.
Them to go walk out. He drops the mic, get out of my office.
Yeah.
But that's basically what that would have been like. Two screens, now get out of my office. It's just like, he's such a character. And yet we, what we know about him, you know, we know a lot of just the facts about him. We know his public comments. And yet the little insights you get into his personality, either from what he says or from what you read about him, is so antithetical to the image Nintendo presents of itself as a company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never get the feeling he was a warm and approachable guy.
No.
No.
Absolutely not.
And yet that's the image they continually try to cater for themselves.
Yeah.
Like you get the image he is almost the character that Reggie jokingly plays himself as, but for real.
Yeah.
Like, just like super intense, super serious all the time.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you have to wonder too, if partially if Nintendo's success was because he was just so ruthless. I mean, that's certainly it wasn't the case with the NES. Was they were just absolutely ruthless with third parties, and that's why third parties
and competition. And, yeah, if you want to put a game on a competitor's console, you're done with us.
Yeah, you're dead to us.
And he was not playing fair from, you know, like when they kind of basically cloned Space Invaders. They were at the receiving end of a lawsuit by Taito. And I think they won that, or there was like a.
It was one of those cases where, like, well, you know, there's a lot of games where you shoot things that are coming straight down.
Yeah. So you know, like he won that lawsuit, but then they went and did to Tengen basically what Taito was doing, right? Like in this sort of way.
The Tengen case was different because Tengen was replicating the control chips that they had put into the NES games to make it so you couldn't produce your own NES game.
Yeah, but it's two sides of the same kind of, property.
Yeah, but see, the beauty of intellectual property law, they were stealing an idea from Taito. Tengen was copying something wholesale. Like, aha. Mm-hmm. Much easier lawsuit to win. But yeah, I mean, the fact that chip even existed is a him move.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, there's a chip that you have to buy from Nintendo to make your game work. On the NES.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like, if you don't have this chip, your game won't work.
Yep.
It's beautiful.
Well, there's also some funny story. I remember, I haven't read Game Over in a long time, but I think it's in Game Over where it talks about, dinner, that he had with, I think, the head of Namco at the time. And it was something to do with Pac-Man. Like, I think maybe he wanted to get Pac-Man on Nintendo consoles or something. But the president of Namco, fell asleep while he was telling a story or something like that. And he was just like, that's it. You're dead to me, pretty much. And he just called the whole thing off. He was so insulted by this guy falling asleep that he was just like, I don't even want to deal with you. I'm out of here.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's classic stuff. I mean, and he was just like that. He was just like, you know what? Like, he was just some sort of like mob boss or something like that. Like, you are going to play by my rules. And if you don't, you're dead. And that's, you know, that's partially why he just had that iron fist. So,
You know, the sad thing is there will never be a tell-all about working under him because no one will ever have the guts to write it. But I have a feeling it would at least be amusing. Some of the stuff that happened at that company must have just been insane.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like,
I mean, because you think about it, this is a company that went from making paper playing cards that you pretty much only would play the game to gamble because there's no fun to be derived in Hanafuda, all the way to making, you know, 3D gaming consoles. Literally 3D in some cases. And then, I mean, It's the transition period of his career has such a clarity of purpose that one person can have despite having so many insane ideas that it kind of makes you wonder what it would be like to work with someone that driven.
Yeah. Mm.
Nintendo back then could really hold a grudge. When Squaresoft went to Sony because of N64 cartridges and all of that. Like, that was a big blow to Nintendo. But in turn, like, Nintendo still had the success of the Game Boy and Game Boy Color, and they just refused Squaresoft to allow Squaresoft to release their games on the Game Boy from then on, you know? And that led to Squaresoft publishing their games on the Wonder Swan designed by Gunpei Yokoi, who left the company because he had been shamed for creating the Virtual Boy. Which lost the company so much money, but, you know, like, he
was responsible for transforming the company.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, he was responsible for much of that company's fortunes, you know, like, and I don't know, like, it's really a screwed up situation when you look at it that way, you know, and, Nintendo, I think, has really softened on that front since he's not on board anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think that Nintendo would really prevent a third party from making 3DS games just because, oh, well, no, you kind of displeased us with that other decision. So, fuck you.
Well, they would not, so you can only make two a year. Which was another one of his grand innovations. Because, and this is his logic, if you're making companies making more than two games a year, you must not be putting enough effort into them. It's like, well, okay. Well, that just meant that companies spawned
valid history.
Oh, there was serious concern there, but that just meant companies just spawned other companies to publish their games.
Oh yeah, yeah,
that's
the,
where you
see
the
that
rise
kind of stuff
of
all the time.
Companies
Konami,
like Ultra.
That's kind of like getting around
Konami made Ultra
Tax Law or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's such a weird, like, as opposed to saying, well, make your games better. It's like, no, you only make two.
Yeah.
It's such a one size fits all rule. Like, if a company could make three good games, why would you tell them no? Well, because they already had two.
Yeah.
That's all they get.
Yep.
And I mean, obviously the quality was the argument they made, but there's a certain amount of market control there as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't want to flood the market with games because then it's not profitable to make games, the games go away, and then the console dies.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was coming from the crash of the Atari 2600.
Yeah, he was pruning the library, basically.
Yeah, because that was one of the things that happened with Atari was the fact that the market was flooded with games that were all garbage, and you know,
Kusuga everywhere.
Yeah, so and that was one of the things that they were trying to. There was a stigma that you know that if you allowed anybody to make a game for your console, that there would be this market flood and a crash, and everybody
and
was trying
that's,
to do
that's
that.
Actually a philosophy that Iwata carried on. I mean, were saying basically saying that same thing as recently as like 3 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, really, like when they're talking about iOS.
Yeah. The famous GDC comments. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. that's the exact same mentality.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean,
so.
But. Yeah, we could spend a lot of time talking about the console crash and how freaking, like, what was it, like, dog food companies had their own Atari games?
Oh, God!
Yeah, like, Purina had, they made...
Chase the Chuck Wagon or something.
I actually have a collection of Atari games. I don't even have an Atari, I have an Intellivision system, but I have a collection of Atari games that I've bought at events that when I saw the game, I just couldn't believe it existed.
Yeah.
Like, that's the metric I use to buy these games. I'm like, that's really a thing?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
that's coming with me.
They became almost like something that you would get in a Happy Meal. They were
disposable. I mean, they were disposable.
Yeah.
That was the problem.
Yeah.
They became disposable. And then once that happens, nobody's making money making games.
Yeah. It was like, it reminds me of that Xbox.
The Sneak King.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of. It reminds me of Sneak King.
I was just about
except
to bring
all
up
the
those.
Games were like that for the 2600. Yeah. That's exactly what it was.
No,
like.
Sneak King is way better.
And also, I think Sneak King was actually not a terrible game based on what I heard.
No, it's actually not a terrible game. It's super shallow and super ridiculous, but
yeah, like Yamauchi, his decisions were in reaction to a very real problem at the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Well, and partially to, again, control the floodgate, so he decided how many games were on the market, so
yeah.
It would remain profitable to make games, and as long as there were companies that were making games, Nintendo was collecting those fat license checks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was basically saying, no, I'm going to save you from yourself.
Yeah.
I mean,
and make a lot
there's
of money
a certain
in the
amount
process.
Of hubris in that. But I will say, so just before we wrap up our discussion of Yamauchi, he got really, really rich.
Yeah, yeah. Millionaire.
He actually decided not to take his severance or his retirement pay from Nintendo and said, you guys can use it better than I can.
Yeah.
Of course, he didn't really need it.
Yeah, I mean.
And then spent an absolute ton of money in retirement building a cancer ward in Kyoto.
Wow.
Yeah, like $75 million, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he spent some serious change on that particular building.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, at one point, he was the richest man in Japan.
Jeez.
And at one point, wasn't Nintendo? Nintendo was actually what worth more than Toyota at one point.
Yeah,
that's recently though. That's I believe that's post Yamauchi.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was
during the Wii years.
Yeah. Yep. But built a very successful company, to say the least.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And. So yeah, I mean, he's a complex figure that ultimately we're never going to know all the gory details of what it was like living the Yamauchi life.
Yeah.
But he's certainly an interesting character from a time period deep in the infancy of console gaming.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure he always wore samurai garb in his house. I can't just picture it.
Yeah, you can't picture him any other way.
Yep.
Yeah. He really did. Did step out of a old school samurai flick, pretty much.
Well, I mean, just as a brief aside, a lot of companies kind of were, a lot of the big Japanese companies, they were kind of like samurai families.
Yeah.
I mean, by kind of, I mean, they were samurai families. Mm-hmm. And they just sort of went from the business of being feudal lords to the business of, what's a good example, the business of farming pearls.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's that mentality is there in the corporate culture. At least it was. But, so, you know, passing of Mr. Yamauchi, 85, obviously important for the industry, but we have to move on.
Yeah. I just want to end with someone on Twitter. Like, that was the best quote. Someone on Twitter said, oh, I'm really surprised that Yamauchi let himself die. It's so out of character.
Yeah, it was Frank Schifaldi. Yeah, that's pretty great.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, there was definitely that sense that he could pretty much do anything he wanted. So,
yep. And that's a sense he created.
Mm-hmm.
So we're only going to have time for one listener mail this week, so I'm going to go ahead and read it. And the listener mail is from Jake, and he writes, "Hey RFN crew, with the recent announcement of Wii Sports Club coming to the Wii U eShop in November, do you think we will see more of these in the future, such as Wii Sports Resort Club? Also, do you guys plan on buying any of the Wii Sports Club minigames, and if so, which ones?" So, to give the brief rundown of what this Wii Sports Club is, just in case you're on the outside looking in here, Nintendo announced they're going to release essentially an HD remake with like Motion Plus controls and everything of Wii Sports, of the core Wii Sports games on the eShop.
Mm-hmm.
When you download the core app, you get 24-hour pass for all sports, and then you got to start paying.
Okay.
That's where the cash comes out. So it's kind of a weird repackaging of a game that was very successful for them, while another game is currently being repackaged in the form of the Wind Waker we released that's mm-hmm. coming out today, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, first to the question at hand, and then we can kind of expand it to a broader topic. You know, Jake wants to know, you know, do we see more of these things coming in the future?
I kind of assumed that we would as I was watching the Nintendo Direct, to be honest.
Yes.
Well, the fact that they're releasing this hub and that the games are coming one after the other, they're not all releasing at the same time. Tennis and...
I think it was tennis and golf.
Tennis and... No, golf is not the first batch. I think bowling. Tennis and bowling are the first ones, and then the other three are undetermined. But yeah, like...
Nobody buy boxing.
No. But yeah, so it just lends itself to add-ons. And I would be very surprised if the Wii Sports Resort games don't end up there somehow.
Yeah. Or at least some of them. Because there's so many Wii Sport Resorts games that it'll probably only be the ones that were most popular.
Yeah.
Which they have metrics data on.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Wii was reporting that data. Hey, isn't that convenient? Like, I don't know that we'll see the bicycle game converted.
Oh.
Like, I don't know anybody who's like, yeah, I love the bicycle game in Wii Sports Resort. I'm just like, why are we doing this? I'm like, well, we could do canoeing. Like, let's do the bicycling game. You could see basketball, I would imagine. They've already got tennis, but you might get ping pong. You could get frisbee dog. You know, these are things that I imagine will come because they're not free money, but they're relatively inexpensive money.
Right.
I would be curious if the Wii Sports Resort enhancements show up in these versions that are coming to the Wii Sports Club. So the little, like the little extra modes that those had, or if they're going to try to sell us those separately.
No, that's the thing that makes me very uninterested in getting these games. It looks like it's going to be, like in the way that they're wording it, it's really the Wii Sports version of these games that's coming. So,
right, even though the Wii Sports Resorts one may have had more features.
Yeah, so they're adding Wii Motion Plus compatibility. So there are improvements being made here. So the golf game is going to be more accurate than the very first Wii Sports Golf. But it probably won't have the same courses or the same modes or whatever it is. You know.
Yeah, bowling had a bunch of mini games in Wii Sports Resort.
Yeah,
that were actually kind
bowling
of fun.
Had like undulating lanes, like it had all these weird modes that Wii Sports didn't have.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see if that stuff and the stat tracking, like the quote workout mode in Wii Sports, comes back in here. I mean, I'm interested in this stuff, but mostly just because it'll give me something to play with people when they're over on the Wii U.
Yeah.
Like something that's approachable to them, that they understand. It's a stepping off point, which is what Wii Sports was for a lot of people experiencing the Wii.
Do we have a good sense of the online model? Like, in terms of the is there going to be voice chat or anything?
So, my understanding is it's based around these clubs, which are like competitions.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm getting it secondhand information. So you join a club and then you basically post scores.
Yeah, see, that's lame. I mean, if it's just like
that
asynchronous play.
Yeah, they were describing these clubs. Like, you can be part of a club and compete within those clubs. But the clubs, you don't make your own club. It's just determined by your your state or province or, you know, your geographical position.
It's geographical.
So, yeah, so it's almost, it sounds like the Wii voting app where it's... Yeah.
It's everybody votes, yeah. Sports edition.
Everybody votes, that's right.
It's everybody sports.
Yeah, but that way then no one gets hurt, no one gets their feelings hurt.
Oh, I hope if you come in last place in the sports club, it just tells you, you're the worst, and then it uninstalls the game.
Yeah.
That'd be amazing.
You do not deserve to be here.
Well, then it doesn't sound a lot different from what they already had in Wii Sports, right? I mean, in the original Wii Sports, you could like see what the other people, you know, you could compare yourself with other people locally.
Yeah,
right?
But only on your Wii.
Right. So it's just an expansion of that effectively.
Right. It's leaderboards. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It's online leaderboards.
Yeah.
Now, if winning like a club for a day, like if that gets you something, or placing well in a club, like there's some real tangible reward there, that could be kind of fun. Like, but that's a limited scope thing, obviously. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, to the broader point, to moving out of the Wii Sports mold, would I be surprised if they made like a minigame collection? What was the one that came with the Wii Remote?
Wii Play?
Yeah, Wii Play and Wii Play Motion. Like, stuff like that being packaged individually or sold as DLC for a hub app. Yeah, I could see that from this point forward, but Wii Sports Resort is sort of Wii Sports is sort of uniquely suited to this sort of packaging that it's kind of a hard sell to figure out what other things can be bundled this way. I mean, there's WarioWare. You could do WarioWare that way. You could sell each character's gameplay set as a premium content, but
I don't think there's enough cachet.
No, exactly. There's just not enough give there.
Yeah, I mean, I could see them developing a new, you know, if this is successful and they decide they like this pricing model for certain types of games, I could certainly see them developing a new product, kind of like what they did for the 3DS Plaza games.
Right.
But I don't know if they're really going to be repackaging old games this way with a bunch of, you know, I don't see them taking Mario Party and, you know, packaging.
No,
like this.
Because most of their party games still have sort of a core central gameplay around them. Wii Sports is so uniquely compartmentalized that it's very easy to break it up into chunks.
Yeah, it lends itself versus, to this, definitely.
Versus like Wii Party, where everything is sort of built on top of this core garbage single player. I'm looking at you, whatever Mario Kart or Mario Party it is, we all ride in the car. God. I mean, and the minigames in those just aren't good enough to justify selling them in packages either. Mm-hmm. They're not deep enough to really get the experience across. Now, in terms of repackaging content they've already produced in sort of higher definition versions, particularly online as transactions, like I said, we saw that with Wind Waker already. You can buy a remake of Star Fox 64 on 3DS right now if you so desire.
I mean, this isn't new. I mean, they were doing the GameCube games that you know, they remade for Wii. I don't know. I mean, Nintendo's been doing stuff kind of like this for a long time. Maybe this pricing model is a new thing.
Right.
But, you know, ever since, like, Mario All-Stars, they've been repackaging old games.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I mean, even their NES releases were repackaged arcade games, the early ones. So, yeah. I mean, the model is really what's interesting, and the use of re-releases to flesh out a launch lineup is an old card of theirs that they've been playing for at least since the DS, where you have Super Mario 64 DS.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a move they've done in the past multiple times, and other publishers are just as guilty of it. This model is just so uniquely suited to Wii Sports.
Mm-hmm.
And Nintendo knows people want bowling, and they want tennis.
Well, person asking us, she's like, oh, here's the new Wii U. Oh, cool, they have bowling? No.
Yeah, it's $9. Cool, done, get it. Yeah. Versus, hey, do they have bowling? Yeah, but you have to buy all this other shit you don't want. It's $50.
Yeah, not going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, the game ultimately is $50 if you buy everything.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's like, well, no, I don't really want, I mean, for me, it's effectively $40 because nobody has ever asked me, hey, man, can we play boxing after they played boxing the first time?
Yeah.
Now you can pay $2 and try it for a couple of hours and only be down $2.
Yeah. But you know what? That could actually work, though, too, because, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe you're over at somebody else's house and you're like, hey, maybe you want to play with your little 10-year-old cousin or something like that, but you don't want to buy the game for it. You know what I mean? Like, really, like, you literally just want to play it for 2 hours, and that's it.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Done.
You know? There's certainly games where it's like, I would buy this, but I know I don't have enough multiplayer, you know, experiences where people at my house to warrant purchasing something. So,
yep.
Right.
I mean, if and it's the ability to rent... I want it, but I'd want it for, like, free occasions, and yeah. Sure, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's times when, especially with Wii Sports and stuff like that, where I knew for a fact that I would never play with Wii Sports with that person again. You know what I mean? Like, whether it was, you know.
Because, what, when they just beat you so bad, you're like, no, never again.
No, but, like, you know, if you're, like, whatever, on holidays or something, and, like, you know, somebody's son comes, you know, is like, oh, hey, you want to play it? Sure. You know, you just download
it. Well, let me download it real quick.
Play it. Done.
Now, Nintendo has done this kind of pricing structure with, in Japan, with the karaoke feature, where you basically pay for a package, like for this many hours or this songs. But I think it makes more sense with karaoke because you're streaming the songs, and I'm guessing that the list of songs gets updated. Here, it's a little bit weirder because, you know, at some point it does get so much cheaper to just outright buy the games, and there's no there's not going to be any updating done to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think they may build franchise. They devote teams to build franchises. They can sell this way. Like, if they could have sold, I mean, a new franchise like Harmonite, they could have built that as packages you could buy individually.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, but that's certainly something they could have done if they built it. So there's nothing limiting a brand new franchise from being packaged this way because we don't have the expectation on it. It's adapting an existing franchise that makes it a little bit more difficult. But, I mean, it's really just they package it in such a way you're thinking, oh, I'm buying pieces of five games, where really what they're selling you are five games you access from the same hub.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you've just played before originally, and they were free, and they came with your
Wii. Yeah. No, I mean, the games that would be most easily adapted to this would be games that would have some sort of a hub. Like, you know, Mario 64, you know?
Oh, that would be evil. That would be so evil.
It would be completely evil, but you could probably...
Oh, we're only going to give you the
shit
levels.
You could probably do it. I mean, you know, you would buy a new painting, and you would install it and hang it.
John,
that's when I will stop playing Nintendo games.
That's exactly it, right? It's completely heresy.
So
it's heresy.
We're going to end the show before John makes me want to go kill myself.
It's absolute heresy, but it could...
Oh my god, you jump through the window in the castle and it just asks you for your credit card?
It could be done.
You want on this slide, you gotta pay. This is Carnival, son.
It's, yeah. So, that's, welcome to the future, people. There you go. You want me to predict something? There you are.
John just brings the whole thing down. And that's how we're gonna end the show, with John ruining it for everybody. Yep. As always, you can send your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We are looking forward to your listener mail. We will probably take a week off from listener mail next week because we will be going to finish up our retroactive of Pandora's Tower, which we will be obviously so picking up next week. There's still time. You can get some gameplay in and go into the talkback over at Nintendo World Report forums. You can get to the podcast section, and then there's a thread devoted entirely to Pandora's Tower. There'll be a link in the article here. Do we have any plugs to go in? TYP, have you got an episode coming out?
Yes, I just recently recorded an episode with Andrew Brown from Australia, and I'm hoping to have that out, I don't know, a week from now maybe.
Okay. Oh, the Aussie.
Yes, yeah, very international.
There you go.
Nintendo World Report here. And,
fantastic.
It was actually, I think, a really fun episode, so I'm looking forward to getting that out.
Awesome. Of course, there's Connectivity, which comes out every week, usually on Saturday, I believe. And they're on their dreaded episode 103.
I don't know.
Which will not be nearly as exciting as ours was. And, of course, we wanted to, I don't know, do we have any plugs left?
I think I'm good.
Yeah, I think that's all
right. And of course, you can go to the website for all your news, reviews, previews, features, et cetera, which is tenderworldreport.com. That's also where you can find me all the time.
You don't want to drive people away from the website.
I want to thank everyone for being here, especially TYP for filling in for Johnny for us this week.
Oh, my pleasure.
It was fantastic having you on. It was an eventful week to get to talk about stuff, so worked out well. And again, thanks to Guillaume and John for joining us this week.
Not a problem.
As always, a pleasure.
I guess just treat John like a guest at this point.
And, treat him like a stranger, James. It'd be preferable.
Get out, John. And that's going to do it for us. So again, thanks for listening, and see you next week.
Later.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.